Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mark Kurlansky, whose latest book is The Eastern Stars, How Baseball Changed the Dominican Town of San Pedro de Macorís, also the author of The Last Fish Tale, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell, 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, Salt, A History of the Basques, a compilation of work from the Federal Writers Project during the 1930s titled The Food of a Younger Land. Foreign correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, has written for several newspapers over the years, began as a theater major and playwright, and then became a journalist. This latest book is about the city of San Pedro Macorís, which has produced more baseball players per capita than pretty much anywhere else in the world. I was fascinated by it because we've been hearing about this town that produced shortstops, though it's also produced outfielders and pitchers, for a long time. What brought you to write this particular book?
I actually didn't start off with the idea of writing about baseball. I started off with the idea of writing about the Dominican Republic. I, for a very long time, had this idea because I've worked in the Caribbean a lot. I covered the Caribbean for the Chicago Tribune for about 8 years, and my first book was about the Caribbean. My first book of fiction was about the Caribbean. So I've written a lot of stuff about the Caribbean. And I had this idea for a long time to write a book about a town somewhere in the Caribbean and just tell its story. Somewhere along the line, I can't remember exactly when, it dawned on me, well, why not a town that's produced 79 Major League Baseball players? So that's sort of the origin of it. When I started the project, I already knew the Dominican Republic quite well.
In the material that came with the book, you talked about what you thought the book was about. Your comment was, this is a book about making it. And to me, the book is about the relationship of America and the Dominican Republic. So the original idea actually came through, in my mind, at least when reading the book.
Yeah, it very much is. And San Pedro was the center of the sugar industry, which had everything to do with the relationship between the U.S. and the Dominican Republic. You know, people try to make a case that Major League Baseball is today's sugar industry with the same implications of exploitation. However, there's a big difference between working at a sugar mill and earning millions playing baseball.
Or even working a bonus and then going to school afterward.
If it doesn't work out, if you just sign and get a bonus and get released before you even leave the Dominican Republic, you still got some money that's going to help your family a lot and change their lives, and you got well fed for a few months.
The reason why this town produces more baseball players is because the sugar industry collapsed. The sugar industry collapsed because corn was given a subsidy in the United States. So it all comes back to the corn subsidy.
That was sort of the nail in the coffin of sugar, but a lot of things went wrong with sugar. I mean, starting with the fact that people just eat a lot less sugar. There was a time in the 19th century when they had this big sugar boom that made San Pedro. Sugar was, for the first time, becoming widely available to the working class. And blue-collar people in North America and Europe started eating enormous amounts of sugar, which they don't do anymore. And it's probably a good thing, unless you're in the sugar business.
The entire story of the relationship of this town and the country to baseball, those of us who are baseball fans, we see it every day. We see it when Robinson Cano is playing for the Yankees or Alfonso Soriano for the Cubs. It goes back to things that we wouldn't expect. San Pedro was the place where immigrants landed from the British colonies in order to cut cane, and they, number one, spoke English, and number two, they brought cricket with them.
Yeah, they were cricket players. San Pedro, in a number of ways, is different from other places in the Dominican Republic. It's blacker. It has Eastern Caribbean food and drink and music and dance, and it's culturally quite different. That all has to do with the people that were brought in for sugar. But the sugar mills, and there were eight of them in San Pedro, were operated by either Americans or Cubans, and this is in the 19th century. And 19th century Americans and Cubans were pretty baseball obsessed, and sugar mills at best operate half the year. Nowadays, they operate about 3 or 4 months a year. And so these baseball nutty Americans and Cubans were looking at their idle workforce in the fields swinging cricket bats and thought, oh, why don't we teach these guys baseball? And they formed these teams. All the mills had teams. They played each other. And by all accounts, it was a very high quality of baseball that they played very competitively year after year, decade after decade.
And what happened was a few things, one of which they couldn't break into the majors because they were black. And so once that color line opened up, suddenly there was room for Latinos. But they were still coming from Cuba. But then in 1959, Cuba shut down.
Well, 63 was the embargo,
okay.
The year of the embargo. And as of that year, there had been 90 Cuban major leaguers and 12 Dominican. Since the embargo, there have been 60 Cuban major leaguers and over 470 Dominican.
Not long ago, there was a huge demonstration in the Dominican because the people there were afraid that the international draft would take place and that would destroy Dominican baseball.
I can't predict if that actually would happen, but I can say that the draft is one of the things that made Dominican baseball boom in the major league. The fact that foreign players were not subject to the draft, that the draft was only for American players. You know, as you know, it's very restricted, and every team can only pick a certain number of players, and the choices are in reverse order of your standing the previous year. There's all these rules about the draft. Free agents are wide open. You can sign as many as you have money for and can find, and anybody can sign any free agent who's willing to go with them. That's why they're called free agents. And all foreigners are, with the exception of Puerto Ricans and Canadians, are free agents. And after that system of draft and free agency was established, there was a tremendous demand to look for foreign free agents, and that's one of the things that really built the Dominicans and San Pedro.
The way I understand it, most teams have camps, baseball camps, mm-hmm. in the Dominican. There are several camps. If a draft happens at, say, age 16 or 17, then all of those younger players who came in at age 11, 12 would have been nurtured for 5 years by one team and could have been signed by another. Why do it at all? And that's what they're afraid of, that these camps would disappear because the camps kind of indenture a player to a particular team.
Not exactly, because the camps, the academies, you don't go to an academy until you've signed. So it would be the same thing, you would go after you were drafted. That would work out pretty much the same. I mean, it would depend how this international draft worked, but the fact that there is no limit to how many free agents you can sign, if they had a draft and it prescribed that each team could only draft a certain number of players, as they can in the U.S., that might mean far fewer Dominicans being signed, also Japanese. But there's a fundamental thing here that a lot of Americans seem to be missing, and that is that the 30 teams in the Major League need slightly over 750 players. And, you know, if you look at the top teams, you look at closers, you know, Papelbaum or Rivera or people like that. Why doesn't every team have a closer like that? Because there aren't that many. You know, why isn't every hitter batting over 300? Why isn't every starting pitcher just unhittable, drop-dead ace? It's hard to find these people, and Major League Baseball is going out and getting them wherever they can find them.
It seems from everything I've read that the bigger players, I think one of the reasons why we're not seeing home run hitters is because the bigger players are going into basketball and football in the United States, so they have to go overseas to find these players.
Yes, there is a decline. There's a very precipitous decline in African American participation now, I think under 10%. But Americans in general, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, ex-major leaguers who work in programs in inner cities in various places. These programs are shutting down for lack of interest. A number of people I talked to said that, you know, soccer is taking over. And, you know, if you go into basketball or football, you play in college, and after college you sign the big contract. You don't go to a farm team for 5 years and low money. Baseball is having trouble competing that way. And also, you know, when I was spending time in San Pedro, in some ways it reminded me of growing up in America in the 1950s. When I was a kid, baseball was the sport. all kids played baseball. All kids thought about baseball. America was focused on baseball. And it's really not that way anymore. Well, it is that way in Cuba and the Dominican Republic and some of these other places, and that's why they're producing a lot of talent.
Mark Kurlansky, Sandy Alderson of Major League Baseball was recently sent down to the Dominican, and in an article that's posted on Yahoo Sports, it talks about corruption in the Dominican, some of which appears in your book. The three areas that are mentioned are identity fraud is rampant, the example being that a 20-year-old would not be signed, but a 16-year-old with the same statistics would be signed for millions of dollars.
Or the 20-year-old might be signed, but for much less money.
In your research, how common was identity fraud? I know that Miguel Tejada was 2 years older than he claimed, another player. Jairo Garcia became Santiago Casilla.
I do write about this in the book somewhat, but it's not that uncommon, and it's not that new. And when I talk to people, you know, old-time people talked about how, you know, for many years, and, you know, in the U.S. this also happens, that scouts will say, listen, kid, you're not 19, you're 16. It's a matter of economics. You know, then you get a David Ortiz, and suddenly at 35, he's hitting like he's 38. They haven't proven that age fraud in that particular case, but I'm very suspicious.
Well, when he was 25, he looked 30. I mean.
Yeah. And the Cubans also, you know, El Duque. It's a commonplace thing, kind of misunderstood. I mean, I think you stated correctly, but Americans hear about this and they think about, you know, underage kids lying about their age and getting in too young. And that also happens, but it's much less common than the reverse of older people lying and saying they're younger than they really are.
Is it, in a way, that much different from a starlet claiming to be 23 so she can get a role in a film rather than being 31?
No, it's not. But it's very simple, basic economics. You know, it takes 4 or 5 years from signing to get to the major league, if you get there at all. And if you're really good, you know, you'll get there. If you can get there in 3.5, 4 years, you're phenomenal. And if you start at 20, you're going to lose half of your best years. And this is taken into consideration in the signing. If you've got a 19-year-old and you want them to get the big money, they're going to have to be a 16-year-old.
Well, the other side of it is a lot of players are only signed for those 6 years before they become free agents.
Right.
So I would think that up until 27, 28, it wouldn't matter because after 32, 33, 34, they can be set free. It doesn't make any difference. They're not going to stay with the same team their entire careers.
Right. But in the Dominican case, what it's about is the signing bonus. 3% of the kids who are signed ever make it to the major league, which means that 97% of these kids, the best money they ever earn is their signing bonus.
Mark Kurlansky, another comment made in this piece, teenagers are injected with steroids meant for horses. Did you see any signs of that?
I thought it was meant for cattle, but animal-grade steroids. The Dominican government doesn't control anything, really. And you can buy anything in any pharmacy in the Dominican Republic. You know, particularly a place like San Pedro, which is an agricultural area, there's lots of stuff in there that's intended for livestock. And, you know, it's cheaper than the other stuff. And I don't know what the medical effect of taking cattle medicine is, but can't be good. A lot of this, And this whole idea about, you know, steroids being Dominican, major leaguers going down and buying the steroids more than the kids there using the Alice Rodriguez finally said when he said anything that he got it down there. And there were always these, you know, it was always said among major league that not just Dominicans, but any players who went down to play winter baseball in the Dominican that, you know, you could use that time to bulk up on steroids. Major League Baseball has started testing kids on signing. They don't sign them if they test positive, and the positive tests are down like about 3%. I don't know if that'll take care of it because suddenly it occurred to me that maybe as they clamp down on steroids, they'll find other substances, and the tests will have to, they'll just have to keep modifying the tests to test for new drugs as they come along. I don't know, but for the moment, testing is in the process of really shutting down steroids. And I don't understand why everybody talks about this like it's a Dominican thing. I mean, you know, Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire and Roger Clemens aren't Dominican.
Did you, in talking to these people down there, Jose Cano, you spoke with Joaquin Andujar and Julio Franco, Alfredo Griffin, George Bell. Did these people ever talk about PEDs with you?
Some did, yeah. The one you want to talk to is Sammy Sosa. He's not talking about it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there's that famous incident when the Sports Illustrated guy asked Sammy, because he believed him, and he says, you know, you're clean. There's a place right by Wrigley Stadium. You know, you can go and you can test yourself. You can invite the press. Sammy Sosa cursed him and walked out. And the reporter said, this is a lesson for young journalists. Always save the steroid question for the end of the interview. Of course, everybody in baseball is very aware of this problem. And Dominicans are very aware of the fact that it to an unfairly great extent is being pinned on them. And they're sensitive about it.
Did any of these people that you spoke with, obviously not Sosa, admit that they knew people who took steroids?
Well, nobody was naming names, but yeah, you know, yeah. They knew that steroids were around.
Do you think Canseco, when he said that like 75% of major leaguers were on one PED or another, you think he was telling the truth?
You know, I don't want to weigh in. I wouldn't know. I don't find it implausible. You have to keep in mind that until quite recently they could do this with impunity, and it seemed to work. I mean, if you calculate how much extra money Roger Clemens has in his pocket because of steroids, Boston traded him because he was at the end of his career, and he was going to fade out in Toronto, and if he made a few hundred million extra dollars with the help of steroids, I mean, people are going to take that chance, especially back before there were consequences for it.
You talk a little bit about the whole Boscone culture, and these are the people who sign the...
They're the people who train. They train the kids up until the signing. They prepare them for their major league tryout, and then when they get signed, they take a percentage of the signing bonus. And that's the only money they get.
Since the book was written, we've heard about team employees, Daniel Wilder, Jose Rijo, who was skimming money and splitting the money with these Boscones. I mean, the signing bonuses were going to the team representatives. They were getting kickbacks. Did that surprise you at all?
No, and I had talked to people about this, and scouts, also deals between Boscones and scouts. You know, it's a very, there again, unregulated business that needs to get regulated. I mean, the Boscones I talked to took between 5 and 35% of a signing bonus. I mean, there was that kind of variation. There's no rules. There's no standard. Most people that I talked to, most families that I talked to, liked the Boscones. They looked at them kind of like friends of the family. This was the guy who took their 12-year-old kid and spent 4 years developing him for the major league and did a good job. The Boscones go and they talk to the family and they cut all kinds of deals. They say, you know, we've got to take a third of this money and split it with the scout. Otherwise, the scout isn't going to make the deal. It changes the life of everyone in the family for this kid to get signed. These are people who struggle to have enough to eat. They have sick people they can't buy medicine for. And so, you know, they're kind of over the barrel. They don't even feel resentful. They just feel that it's part of the game. And in a sense, it is. There are no rules. There are no laws saying this is what a Boscone is allowed to do and this is what he's not allowed to do. So it needs to get regulated.
Mark Holansky, in all your research, what surprised you the most? What didn't you know that just kind of hit you in the face?
Well, there were a number of things, but one of the things I have to say that completely surprised me that I wasn't ready for was how much negative feeling there is in the U.S. about Dominican players, this whole attitude of there's too many foreigners in baseball. One of the first things I did was I wrote an article about San Pedro for Parade magazine. It ran on the cover and got a lot of attention. And I got over 100 letters, most of them saying either too many foreigners, too many Dominicans, too many Latinos. I think it's an appalling attitude, and I'm really surprised at how widespread it is. I mean, these people are you know, they're very hardworking, and they have a tremendous amount of talent. And, you know, it never occurred to me that this was anything but admirable, what they're doing.
Well, after reading The Eastern Stars, I rented a movie called Sugar.
I intentionally didn't see it when I was working on the book because it's fictional, and, you know, sometimes you're writing a book and you think, well, I seem to remember something or other, and then later you realize, oops, I saw that in a movie.
Would you go to San Pedro de Macorís on holiday?
I have. I brought my family there, but that's because I was working there. What is unfortunate is that, you know, there are a number of resorts outside of San Pedro, technically in San Pedro, and you never see tourists in the town, you know, because these resorts are all your food and drinks and everything are paid for, and that's what Dominican tourism is. I mean, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that nobody sees this place even though they go there. San Pedro is actually not that far from the airport that services Santo Domingo, but La Romana, for example, which is just the next town over, they built another airport there so that you didn't have to drive through Boca Chica and San Pedro to get to your resort in La Romana. They want people to see as little as possible of the Dominican Republic, which, you know, because they're afraid it'll weigh on people to see the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere while they're floating in the pool having pina coladas. And, you know, it's an interesting place with a very rich culture, and people should see it.
The other thing I was thinking is you could go down there, and I'm sure you sat and watched some of these ball games between these players, and that must be pretty exciting.
It's fantastic. There's ball games everywhere. There's little kids playing with wadded-up socks, and there's major leaguers playing each other, and there's just all sorts of levels in between. And the kids there play great baseball. They play really hard. It seems the first thing that develops is arms. They all have these great arms. You know, sometimes they don't have great hands. And if you love baseball, it's a great place to hang out.
The subtext of the book, of course, is American imperialism.
I mean, well, that's the subtext of the Dominican Republic.
I guess just generally, as you talk about, it's kind of the Dominican Republic is one of those places that gets ignored. It's sort of like Belgium or New Jersey, you know.
The last time the Dominican Republic was in the front line of the news was when Columbus landed there. And it's always been sort of out of step with the world. You know, it didn't have the same kind of independence movements as other colonies did. It didn't even have its own abolitionist movement. It didn't even really have that much slavery. The little slavery it did have was ended by the Haitians when they invaded. The Dominicans tried to get annexed by the United States when Ulysses Grant was president, and it turned out that most people in Congress didn't want it. Charles Sumner, an old-time Massachusetts abolitionist, sort of spearheaded the movement in the Senate to stop the annexation. And he's sort of remembered heroically in the Dominican Republic now.
What do you think the effect of this the Haitian earthquake is having on the Dominican right now?
A number of things. You have to put it in the context of the relationship between. When I was a Caribbean correspondent, I often flew to Miami to get from Port-au-Prince to Santo Domingo because there was no way of getting across. These two countries have not had good relations. And there are very negative attitudes about Haitians in the Dominican Republic. But they've acted pretty well on this one. And you know, it's kind of sobering to realize you're living on the same fault line. And it's not like Dominican housing and construction is any better than Haitian. They've understood and sympathized. But on the other hand, you know, Dominican Republic is not a country that's set up to help other countries or to take in refugees. Or, you know, Haiti is the only country that makes Dominican Republic look like it's doing okay.
Being reminded of the story of Rafael Trujillo, the, as you call him, the kleptocrat of the Caribbean,
right.
And the United States supported him until finally one day John F. Kennedy said enough is enough.
This, to me, really shows the whole nature of the U.S.-Dominican relationship. I mean, they created this guy. They sent him to officer training school, and they pulled out the troops and let this guy take over, and Roosevelt and Truman accepted it because he said he was anti-fascist, and then Truman and Eisenhower accepted him because he said he was anti-communist, and finally, he just started going a little too far, especially when he started trying to assassinate other world leaders. And Kennedy said, this guy's just out of control. Kill him.
It reminds me, in a way, of Diem in Vietnam and Saddam Hussein.
Yes, yes, very much, very much.
Mark Kurlansky, changing the subject slightly, how did you get involved with a book about food articles written for the Federal Writers Project, the articles that became The Food of a Younger Land?
I originally stumbled across an article that Nelson Algren had written that ended up in his papers when he died. It was explained that this was something he had written for a Federal Writers Project called America Eats, about what Americans were eating, that was never published. And I thought, whoa, I'd like to see that. And so because it was WPA, and because WPA things tend to end up in the Library of Congress, I called them, and they said that they had boxes of the stuff. Then I found additional stuff in some other places. The Municipal Archives in New York had stuff, additional stuff that wasn't in the Library of Congress. You know, it was like finding this time capsule. I mean, these completely unedited manuscripts from 1939, 1940.
By sometimes famous people.
By sometimes, you know, Dora Welty and Algren, and also people that you never heard of. And it was kind of fun to try to figure out who some of these people were. Some of them I never could figure out, but a lot of them I could. And a lot of them were writers who, you know, had some kind of a reputation in 1940 that have been forgotten or only remembered locally in the region now. So it was kind of a fun bit of detective work. But it also gave this picture of America and American food that's very different from today. An America that I remember the last vestiges of as a child growing up in the 1950s in New England. I had relatives in San Francisco. We used to drive across the country, family of six, comfortably seated in this huge Buick. And the food would change from county to county, and there weren't highways, and there weren't fast food places. And you knew exactly where you were when you ate lunch or you had dinner because it was different everywhere.
The sense I get is that regionalism has disappeared. Obviously, we go into a mall in, you know, Mobile, Alabama, and it's the same mall that we'll see in Seattle, Washington, or in Bangor, Maine. But we've also lost food regionalism as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only the recipes, but some of the traditions, the get-togethers. But I was amazed in doing Food of Younger Land how many of these traditions still exist regionally, maybe on a more obscure scale. But I would go on talk radio shows, and people would say, you know, I've done that. People in Georgia said, yeah, I went to Coca-Cola parties.
Did you get a chance? Obviously, you wrote the book from the papers, but then you went on tour. Did you get a chance while you were on tour to check out some of the more obscure cuisines?
I did some of them, yeah.
What was the strangest one you found?
I think the strangest has to be gooey ducks. In Washington State and British Columbia, I think it's the only place in the world that has these. It's like a giant, what we call a New England steamer, you know, the world's biggest steamer. They're too large to eat like a clam, you know, you have to slice them, and they're extremely obscene.
Mark Kurlansky, you've also written a lot about fish and oysters, cod. In terms of that, how safe are our oceans these days? Are they being fished out? Are we beginning to get control?
What seems to be happening, I mean, there's a lot of different variations from place to place, and actually the West Coast is doing better than the East Coast. But there's a lot of places, for instance, New England cod. New England cod, you can't say at this point it's being overfished, but it's still not coming back. And things aren't responding to the controls that are put on them in the way that they should be. And there's been a moratorium on cod in the Canadian Grand Banks since 1994, and it shows almost no sign of recovery. This is very worrisome. I think that not enough has been done to look into the effects of climate change and the effects of pollution, because within U.S. territorial waters at this point, there's not a tremendous amount of overfishing going on, and that isn't to say that the fish stocks are coming back, so something else is going on.
The Perfect Storm by Sebastian Younger talked a lot about these giant boats from Japan that had huge nets that trolled along the bottom taking everything in their path.
It's a funny thing. I worked as a commercial fisherman as a kid in the 1960s, before there was a 200-mile limit. And all the fishermen were talking about these Russians and Japanese overfishing American waters. So in the 70s, the Magnuson Act, they were barred from American waters. We took their place and did more destruction than the Russians and Japanese were doing when it was open. People always love to talk about the foreigners. And I talk in my cod book about this old-time fisherman in Cornwall in southern England. And he talked about how in his lifetime, fishing since the 1950s, he's seen less and less cod. I said, well, why do you think that is? And he said, well, it's the Spanish. The reason I was talking to him is there was this big fuss because the European community had just given permission for the first four Spanish boats to fish in this guy's waters. I said, you know, come on, they just got here last week. And he says, oh, yeah, that's right, isn't it? And he sort of scratches his chin and says, I think it's the Scots.
Mark Kurlansky, you're an old journalist, time journalist from the 70s on, and you worked in several newspapers. A couple of quick questions about journalism today. One thing I've noticed is the Tea Party narrative. 3,000 to 5,000 people showed up to listen to Sarah Palin in Boston. The PA didn't work. Everybody left early. There were just a few thousand in Washington. When I looked online to check it out, none of the newspapers reported the number of people at these things as if promoting them. It seems to me that there's some kind of narrative going on that has very little to do with reality.
Yeah, and when the war in Iraq first started and there were huge, some of the biggest anti-war demonstrations I've ever seen, and I went to all the big Vietnam ones, that was so underreported. Yeah, there certainly is something going on. It's partly the death of newspapers. I mean, they're just dying. They're working on an economic equation that isn't working. They're not getting the same quality of people, and a lot of news is being led by television and internet and people who have no concept of the kind of standards and ethics that I was taught as a journalist. And a lot of people, you know, there has become this thing with young journalists of, you know, you just try to do any outlandish thing to draw attention to yourself. And, I mean, Sarah Palin is not a journalist, but an example. What is Sarah Palin's scenario? It's to, you know, make a name for herself, be a celebrity, and make lots of money. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that's their goal, and that's their concept of journalism. And it's really scary, and I fear for where we're going to be getting our news in the future.
The Daily News, in its initial report about the Palin thing, made the comment that an impressive crowd of 3,000 to 5,000, I was thinking, yeah, impressive, you know, if you're going to see Wicked, but not very impressive otherwise. And yet in a later edition online, no mention was made. The New York Times, no mention of the size of these crowds was made. No mention was made of the fact that there was no PA. Yeah. What are they gaining?
For a long time, for as long as I can remember, established news organizations have had a bias against demonstrations of all kinds. They just don't report them well. They don't deal with the whole idea of people getting out on the street, and they undercover it. They don't cover it realistically. This has always been true, and, you know, I get news for people. If you don't go to a demonstration, you're never going to find out what really happened there.
So over-reporting, under-reporting, but it seems like over-reporting is, you know, making too much of it seems to always be what happens when it's the right wing and under-reporting when it's the left.
I think it's about a certain desperation to make things into stories. I think the whole Tea Party movement is over-reported.
It's about narrative.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's over-reported, and I think their power and influence is greatly overstated. And I think it's because they think it's a good story. I mean, you saw this in the Massachusetts Senate race where, you know, it was reported that, you know, the Tea Party had gotten into liberal Democratic Massachusetts and taken the seat away from the Democrats. And it turned out that in reality, the Democrat ran a terrible campaign. The Republican ran a pretty good campaign and wants nothing to do with the Tea Party. It had absolutely nothing to do with the Tea Party. It had to do with old-fashioned politics and one party doing it badly and the other party doing it well.
Will newspapers survive?
I don't think they'll survive in print. I think they'll survive online. And I think that there will be a tremendous sorting out of online news in general, and that if you look at the history of print, there was a sorting out. But the problem with online news is that print created these institutions that had money to build bureaus all over the world and to hire investigative reporters who could work on a story for 3 years without delivering any copy, and all of these good things that you need to do in journalism. And so far, they haven't arrived at a formula for online news that generates the kind of money to do that level and quality of journalism, and I hope they figure it out.
It seems right now that that journalism is being conducted pretty much by The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Nation. That's about it.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a few good things online, and there's books, and there's Stephen Colbert.
Mark Kurlansky, you've gone literally all over the map in your various books. What are you working on now?
My next book, which is done, is coming out in November, and it's fiction. It's a collection of short stories called Edible Stories, and there are 16 interrelated stories, characters keep popping up, that are all about people's connections to different foods. There's an Italian terrorist who drinks too much espresso, and a woman with a pathological fear of creme brulee, and a woman who breaks up with her boyfriend because he brings gourmet food to the baseball stadium.
And nonfiction?
I have a book coming out next year about Hank Greenberg, the great Jewish hitter of the 1930s, and I'm working on a biography of Clarence Birdseye, the father of the frozen food industry, who, through his genius and imagination, ruined food.
You've been listening to an interview with Mark Kurlansky, whose latest book is The Eastern Stars, How Baseball Changed the Dominican Town of San Pedro de Macorís. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.